I asked. He shook his head. We may be in here a while. Talking is thirsty work, Zabrowski said from the back. Heinrich's eyes flicked to him and then back to me. Silence is not thirsty work. His lips quirked, and it was almost a smile. If sometime during this interview you want to tell us exactly why you were following me, I'd love to hear it. But that's really secondary to why we're here. He looked puzzled then. When you first stopped us, that seemed to be very important to you. It was, and I'd still like to know, but the priorities have changed. He frowned at me. You are playing games, Miss Blake. I am tired of games. There was no fear in him. He seemed tired, wary, and not happy, but he wasn't afraid. He wasn't afraid of the police, or me, or going to jail. There was none of that anxiety that most people have in a police interrogation. It was odd. Bradley had said that our government was going to just let Heinrich go. Did he suspect that? Know that? If so, how? How did he know? Why wasn't he the least bit afraid of spending time in the St. Louis jail system? I opened the first file. It held grainy copies of the old crimes. Women Van Anders had slaughtered in foreign countries, far from here. I laid the photos out in front of him, in a neat row of black and white carnage. In some of the photos, the quality was so bad that if you hadn't known that you were looking at human remains, you'd never have guessed. Van Anders had reduced his victims to Rorschach tests. Heinrich looked bored now, almost disgusted. Your detective O'Brien has already shown me these, already marched out her lies. What lies would those be? I asked. I sipped my coffee, and it wasn't bad. It was fresh, at least. As I sipped, I watched his face. He folded his arms across his chest. Data, there are fresh murders here, in your city, like these old ones. What makes you think she's lying? He started to say something, then closed his mouth tight, his lips a thin, angry line. He just glared at me, pale eyes bright with anger. I opened the second file folder and began laying out colored photos just above the old black and whites. I laid them out in a line of bright death and watched all the color drain away from Heinrich's skin. He looked almost gray by the time I sat back down. I had to stand to reach the ends of the table to lay out the photos. This woman was killed 3 days ago. I got another file out of the stack. I opened it and fanned the photos on top of it, but didn't push them with the stack. I wasn't 100% sure I'd be able to match the photos back to the right crime. They were supposed to be marked on the back, but I hadn't marked them personally, so I didn't want to risk it. Once you get into court, the lawyers get so damn picky about evidence and stuff. I pointed to the file pictures. This woman was killed 2 days ago. Zabrowski stepped forward and handed me a plastic baggie with a handful of Polaroids in it. I tossed the baggie across the table so that it slid by him, and he caught it automatically before it hit the floor. His eyes were very big when he saw the top print. Those women died last night. We think there are two victims, but truthfully we haven't finished putting together the pieces, so we're not 100% certain. It could be more, or it could be just one woman, but that's an awful lot of blood for only one woman, don't you think? He laid the baggy Polaroids carefully on the table so that they didn't touch any of the other photos. He stared at all the pictures, his face gone death white, his eyes huge. His voice squeezed out like it was an effort to breathe, let alone talk. What do you wish to know? We want to stop this from happening again, I said. He was staring down at the pictures, as if he couldn't look away. He promised he would not do it here. He swore that he could control himself. Who? I asked, softly. Yeah, the government had given him a name, but that was the same government that wouldn't give our John Doe one. Van Anders. He whispered the name. He looked up, and there was surprise underneath the shock. The other detective said you knew it was Van Anders. Great. Nothing like giving your suspect more information than he's giving you. I shrugged. Without eyewitnesses, it's hard to be certain. Something like hope sparked in his eyes, and he started regaining some of his color. You think this might be someone else, not Van Anders. I riffled through the papers again, and Heinrich flinched. I found the thin folder with the picture of Van Anders and the two women. I flashed in the picture. Van Anders with the victims from last night's slaughter. He winced at the last word, and the color that had been seeping back into his face drained away again. His lips looked bloodless. For a second I thought he might faint. I'd never had a suspect faint on me before. His voice was a hoarse whisper. Then it is him. He laid his forehead on the table. Do you need some water? Something stronger? I asked. Though truthfully, black coffee was as strong as I could give him. There were rules about giving liquor to suspects. He raised his head, slowly, but he looked awful. I told them that he was crazy. I told them not to include him. Told who? I asked. He sat up a little straighter. I agreed to come here against my better judgment. I knew the team was assembled too quickly. When you rush such a task, it ends badly. What task? I asked. To recruit you for a mission. What mission? I asked. He shook his head. It doesn't matter now. Some of our people got you on tape raising a man in a local cemetery. He did not look alive enough for what my employers wished. He looked like a zombie, and that is not good enough. Good enough for what? I asked. To fool people into country that their leader is still alive. What country? I asked. He shook his head, and a ghost of a smile crossed his lips. I will not be here long, Miss Blake. Those that employ me will see to it. They will either work to free me soon with no charges, or they will have me killed. You seem calm about that, I said. I believe I will go free. But you're not sure, I said. Few things in life are certain. I know one thing that's certain, I said. He just looked at me. I think he'd said more than he planned to say, so he's going to try not to say anything. Van Anders will kill someone else tonight. His eyes were bleak when he said, I had worked with him years ago, before I knew what he was. I should not have believed him that he was in control of his rage. I should have known. Are your employers just going to leave Van Anders here to butcher more women? He looked at me then. Again, I couldn't quite read his expression. Determination? Guilt? Something. I know Van Anders is staying. I will give you that address. I know that my employers would wish him dead now. He has become a liability. We got the address from him. I didn't hurry out after it, because unlike the movies, I knew that I wouldn't be allowed in at the capture. Mobile Reserve, St. Louis's answer to SWAT, would be the ones running the show. When you have people that can go in with body armor and fully automatic weapons, the rest of us are just outclassed. I opened the last file folder and showed him the man that they'd crucified against the wall. Why did you need Van Anders to do this? Not his kind of kill. I don't know what you are talking about. He was going to deny it. Fine. Even if we could have pinned it on him, I doubt that we could have kept him long enough for trial. We know you and your team did this. We even know why. If Bradley was telling the truth, I did know. You know nothing. He sounded very sure of that. You were ordered to kill him because he ran. Ran away from people like you and people like Van Anders. He looked at me then, and he was worried. He was wondering how much I knew. Not much, but maybe it was enough. Whose idea was it to crucify him? Van Anders. He looked like he had swallowed something sour. Then he gave a small smile. It won't matter, Miss Blake. I will never see trial. Maybe not, but I always like to know where the blame goes. He nodded, then said, Van Anders was so angry when we shot him first. He said, what good is a crucifixion if that person isn't struggling? He looked at me with haunted eyes. I should have known then what he meant to do. Whose idea were the runes? I asked. He shook his head. You've gotten the last startled confession you shall get from me. There's still one thing I don't understand. Actually, there were lots of things I didn't understand, but it's never good to appear confused in front of the bad guys. I will not incriminate myself, Miss Blake. If you knew what Van Anders was capable of, then why bring him along? Why make him part of the team at all? He is a werewolf, as you have learned from what he does to his victims. There were those who believed you were a shapeshifter as well. We wanted someone that could manage you without risk of infection if you fought us. You were planning on kidnapping me. As a last resort, he said. But because Balfour and Conducci didn't like my zombie, the plan is off? Those names will do for them, but yes. We had reports you could raise zombies that thought they were still alive and could pass as human. My employers were very disappointed when they saw the tape. I owed Marianne and her coven a thank-you note. If they hadn't gotten all witchier than thou on me, I'd have raised a fine, alive-looking zombie, and I might even now be kidnapped and at the mercy of Van Anders. Maybe I should send Marianne flowers. A card just didn't seem to be enough. I tried some more questions, but Leopold Heinrich had given out all the information he was going to give. He finally asked for a lawyer, and the interview was over. I stepped out into the main area, and it was in chaos, people yelling, running. I caught the phrase, "Officers down!" I grabbed Detective Webster of the blonde hair and bad coffee. "What's happened?" O'Brien answered for him. "The Mulberry Reserve Squad that went out to pick up Van Anders. He cut him up. At least one dead, maybe more." "Shit," I said. She had her jacket on and was digging her purse out of a drawer. "Where's Zabrowski?" "He's gone already. Can I catch a ride?" She looked at me. "Where to? I'm going to the hospital." "I think I need to be at the crime scene." "I'll take you," Webster said. O'Brien gave him a look. "I'll be at the hospital later, I promise." O'Brien shook her head and ran for the door. Everyone was leaving. Some would go to the hospital. Some would go to the crime scene and see if they could help there. Some would go sit with the families of the downed officers. But everyone would go. If you really wanted to commit a crime in any city, wait until there's an officer down call. Everyone drops everything. I'd go to the scene of the crime. I'd try to help figure out what went wrong. Because something had gone very wrong if Van Anders had taken out an entire squad from the Mobile Reserve. They were trained to handle terrorists, hostage situations, drugs, gangs, biochemical hazards. Pick your nastiness. The Mobile Reserve could handle it. Yes, something had gone terribly wrong. The question was what? Chapter 58. I'd seen enough of Van Anders' handiwork to be prepared for the worst. What I saw in the hallway wasn't even close to his worst. Compared to the other crime scenes, it was almost clean. There was a uniformed officer standing next to the window at the end of the hallway. The window was almost completely free of glass, as if something large had been thrown through it. I turned away from the thought of one of the city's finest plunging to his death. Other than the window, there wasn't much else. A sprinkling of blood on the pale brown carpet in the hallway. Two blood smears on the wall looked almost artificial, overly dramatic on the off-white walls. That was all. Van Anders hadn't had time to enjoy himself. One officer was dead, maybe two, but he'd just had time to kill them. He hadn't had time to cut them up. I wondered if that made him angry. Did he feel cheated? There was a trickle of police in the hallway, but the sounds of voices from the open door of the apartment was as murmurous as the sea. A sorrowful, angry, urgent, confused sea. The apartment was pristine, untouched. There had been no fight inside. All the trouble had started and ended in the hallway. Detective Webster had come up with me. He was still in the doorway because there wasn't room to walk into the room. Every homicide has more cops than you think it needs, but I'd never seen a crowd like this. It was nearly wall-to-wall people, like at a party, except that every face was grim or shocked or angry. No one was having a good time. Zabrowski had called my cell phone in the car on the way there. Everybody was wanting answers, answers about the monster, answers that he couldn't give because he didn't fucking know. His quote, not mine. I debated on whether to yell for Zabrowski or call him back on his cell phone. I don't usually mind being short, but this time I couldn't see through the crowd, and I sure as hell couldn't see over it. I glanced at Webster. He was damn near 6 feet. "Can you spot Sergeant Zabrowski?" Webster suddenly looked even taller. I realized that he'd been slumping, artfully, the way some tall people do, especially if they got tall early and didn't like it. Standing with his shoulders back and trying to gaze across the crowd, he was at least 6'1", maybe an inch more. I'm usually a pretty good judge of height. "He's on the far side of the room." He suddenly seemed to shrink, shoulders rounding, almost like his spine compressed before my eyes. I shook my head and said, "Can you get his attention?" He got a mischievous grin on his face, a look that Zabrowski and Jason had made me dread. "I could put you on my shoulders, then he could spot you." I gave him a look that wilted the grin into a smile. He shrugged. "Sorry." But it was the kind of sorry I'm used to, the one Jason always gives when he's not sorry at all. Either Zabrowski was more of a psychic than I thought, or he was trying to get away from the man who was dogging him. It was one of the Mobile Reserve officers in full combat black, body armor still in place. But he'd lost his helmet, his mask. His eyes were wild. The whites kept flashing like a horse's when it's about to bolt. Zabrowski saw me, and the look of relief on his face was so pure, so happy, that it almost scared me. "Officer Ellsworthy, this is Anita Blake, Marshal Anita Blake. She's our preternatural expert." Ellsworthy frowned, blinking a little too rapidly. It was as if it took longer than it should have for the words to filter through and have meaning. I'd have seen enough shock to know the symptoms. Why wasn't he at the hospital with the rest of his squad? Zabrowski mouthed sorry to me. Ellsworthy blinked at me. His brown eyes didn't even look like they were focusing, as if what he was seeing was somewhere inside his head. Shit. A moment ago he'd been yelling at Zabrowski. Now he's staring at things that we couldn't see. Probably reliving the disaster. He was pale, and there was a light dew of sweat on his face. I was betting he'd be clammy to the touch. I put my face close to Zabrowski and spoke low. "Why isn't he at the hospital with the others?"
"He wouldn't go. Said he wanted to ask RPIT how the hell a werewolf can grow claws when it's still in human form."
I must have reacted to the question because Zabrowski suddenly gave me a look through the rims of his glasses. I told him it wasn't possible for a shifter to gain claws while still in human form. Was I wrong? I nodded. A shifter has to be really powerful to be able to do it. I've only known a handful that could do partial change while they pretty much looked human. Zabrowski lowered his voice even more.
It might have been good to know that before they busted in on Van Anders.
I thought a minimum of one person from each squad went down to Quantico for the big preternatural class and lecture.
They did.
I gave him a disgusted look. I don't go around assuming that I know more about the monsters than the freaking FBI.
Maybe you should, Zabrowski said softly.
The way he said it took the heat out of my words. I couldn't really get angry with Ellsworthy standing there blinking like an innocent come to slaughter.
"Is it hot in here?"
Ellsworthy asked. Actually, it was. Too many people in too small a space. "Detective Webster, take Ellsworthy out into the hall for a breath of fresh air, would you?" Webster did what I asked, and Ellsworthy went without a single complaint. It was as if he used up all his anger before I got there, and now all that was left was the shock and horror of it all. Zabrowski and I stayed in our little corner.
"What went wrong?" I asked.
"I've been yelled at by Ellsworthy, but even better, Captain Parker. He's waiting at the hospital for me to get my ass down there and explain to him how the hell Van Anders was able to do what he did."
"What exactly did he do?"
Zabrowski dug his ever-present notebook out of his jacket pocket. The notebook looked like it had been rolled in the dirt, then stepped on. He ruffled through it until he got the pages he wanted. Van Anders cooperated completely when they came in. He seemed surprised and didn't know why anyone would want to arrest him. He was handcuffed, patted down, and the two technical officers, Bates and Meyer, led him out into the hallway, while the rest of the squad reformed and made sure the rest of the apartment was clear. He glanced up at me. Standard procedure.
So, when did it stop being standard?
Then it gets a little confused. Meyer never came back on the radio, at all. Bates started yelling officer down and something about, "He's got claws." Ellsworthy and another officer got out the door in time to see Van Anders clear enough that they both swear he had claws, but was in human form. Zabrowski gave me a look. Truthfully, I was ready to think Ellsworthy and, he turned a page of his notebook, Tucker, were seeing things. I shook my head.
"No?
It's possible." I shook my head again and fought the urge to rub my temples. I had a headache starting. The lycanthropes that I'd seen do this, the claws just whip out. It's like having five switchblades suddenly appear. There wouldn't have been anything for the officer Bates, was it? To see.
Meyer, Bates is still alive.
I nodded. Names were important. It was important to remember who was dead and who was alive. Van Anders stabbed Meyer. When the claws shot out of his fingertips, he used them like knives. "Apparently Kevlar doesn't stop lycanthrope claws," Zabrowski said. "Kevlar isn't made to stop a stabbing attack," I said. "The claws acted like blades." He nodded. "Van Anders used the officer as a shield. Held him on his claws like a puppet," is what Ellsworthy finally said. "He should have gone to the hospital with the others," I said. "He looked fine when I got here, Anita, honest. I don't blame them for not forcing him to go."
"Well, he doesn't look fine now."
"We can give him a ride to the hospital when we go." I looked at him.
Why do I think that we are going to the hospital for more than just a show of moral support? You're just perceptive as hell tonight.
Zabrowski, I said.
I told Captain Parker that I'd be right along once Marshal Blake showed up.
You bastard. He's asking questions about the monsters that I don't have the answers to.
Maybe Dolph would, but there's no way I want him to be here. We just managed to quiet down the worst of what happened in the interrogation with your furry friend. But if Dolph loses it in a public setting...
He just shook his head.
I agreed with him.
Fine. I'll go with you to the hospital and see if I can answer the captain's questions.
Ah, but first you gotta see this.
He was actually smiling, and it wasn't a place for smiles.
See what? I asked suspiciously.
He turned without a word and led the way down the hallway towards the empty window. Webster had taken Ellsworthy in the opposite direction so that they stood as far from the window as the hallway allowed. Good for Webster. When we were close enough, my eyes started looking at something besides the window. There were two neat bullet holes in the wall, near the window at the end of the hallway. Mobile Reserve's weapons can go fully automatic at the flick of a switch, but they're trained to do it one bullet at a time. With two officers down and a monster on the loose, they'd remembered their training. Zabrowski motioned the uniform back, so we had some privacy. There was almost no glass on the carpet because it had all gone outside.
Did Van Anders throw someone through the window?
He threw himself, Zabrowski said.
I stared at him. We're 20 stories up. Even a werewolf isn't going to walk away from that kind of fall. It may not kill him, but he'll be hurting.
He didn't go down. He went up.
He motioned me closer to the window. I didn't like the window. It had a very low sill, almost low enough to step through. That gives a better view, but without glass in the metal frame, there was nothing but empty air between me and a very big fall.
Careful of the glass, and don't look down.
But trust me, Anita, it's worth leaning out just a little and looking up. Look at the right side of the window. I placed a hand against the wall and found a place in the metal that was glass-free so I could get a grip. The air was beating against me, like eager hands ready to snatch me away. I'm not afraid of heights, but the idea of falling from them, well, that I'm afraid of. I fought the almost irresistible urge to look down, because I knew if I looked down, I might not be able to look out the window at all. I leaned out, very carefully. At first, I didn't understand what I was seeing. There were holes in the side of the building, all the way up, as far as my eyes could follow, small holes at regular intervals. I eased myself back in, carefully, watching for glass as much as a fall. I frowned at Zabrowski. I saw the holes, but what are they?
Van Anders did a Spider-Man on them.
The sniper and observer were set up on the opposite side of the building. There was nothing they could do. I felt my eyes go wide.
You mean the holes are where he shoved his hands into the building and climbed up?
Zabrowski nodded, and he was smiling. Captain Parker was screaming that he didn't know werewolves could do that either. I glanced back at the window. Captain Parker isn't the only one that didn't know. I mean, I know they have the strength, but they'd get cut and scraped and break bones even. They may heal quickly, but it hurts them.
I looked up at the ceiling, as if I could still see the upward march of holes.
Being shot would have hurt like hell.
Zabrowski nodded.
Will he need to see an emergency room? A doctor or something?
I shook my head.
I doubt it. If he's strong enough to do a partial change, then I'll have to assume that his healing abilities are on the high end. If they are, he'll be healed within a few hours, maybe less. If he changes form when he's human again, he'll be good as new.
They put the word out to all the emergency and urgent care places, just in case.
I nodded. Can't hurt, I guess, but I don't think you're going to catch him that way.
How are we going to catch him, Anita?
How do you catch something like this?
I looked at him.
Did you ask the upper brass what they thought of using werewolves to track him?
They vetoed it.
I think you might find them in a more receptive mood now.
You think your friends will be nice on a leash for me?
I was really thinking I'd be holding the leash. My phone rang, and the sound made me jump. I flipped it open, and it was a voice I didn't recognize. I don't talk to the chief of police all that often. I did a lot of yes, sir, no, sir. Then the phone was buzzing, and I was left with Zabrowski staring at me.
Were you talking to who I think you were talking to?
They've issued a court order of execution for Van Anders. Zabrowski's eyes were wide. You're not going after him alone. I shook my head. I hadn't planned on it. He looked like he didn't believe me. I actually had to give him my word I wouldn't try to pop Van Anders without backup. I'd have backup. The police chief had told me over the phone that they'd go along with the werewolf tracking idea. I'd have backup. If I could persuade Richard to give them to me. I asked for some plastic evidence bags and raided Van Anders' dirty clothes drawer. I used gloves, not to keep my scent off them, but because I didn't want to touch anything that had touched Van Anders' body. I sealed the clothes in a bag and hoped it would be enough to help the werewolves track him. We'd come back and start around the foot of this building. Van Anders might have climbed up, but he had to come down somewhere. Zabrowski drove me, Officer Ellsworthy, and himself to the hospital, so Captain Parker could yell at us both. Bates had died on the operating table. Zabrowski had to take the tongue-lashing, because a sergeant doesn't outrank a captain. I took it because I smelled the fear on Parker. I didn't blame him for being afraid. I think we were all afraid. Every single person in the hallway, every person in the apartment, every policeman and woman in town should have been afraid. Because when something like this happens, it's still the police that have to clean up the mess. Well, the police and your friendly neighborhood executioner. We were all afraid, and we should have been. Chapter 59. I met Richard at his house. We sat at the kitchen table where we'd sat so many weekend mornings. He drank tea. I sipped coffee. He wouldn't meet my eyes, and I didn't know what to say. He caught me off guard by starting, "If you'd stuck to my morals, Asher would be dead right now. Or worse, trapped in Europe with that monstrous bitch." I was pretty sure that monstrous bitch was Belle Mort. "That's true," I said, and I tried to keep my voice neutral. I wanted to get down to business and ask Richard to loan me some werewolves, but it didn't usually work well to approach Richard head-on. It didn't take much to offend him. I needed his cooperation, not another fight. "I don't understand how you could let them feed off you, Anita." He finally looked up, and his perfectly brown eyes were filled with pain and confusion so raw that it hurt me to look at them. "It's hard for me to cast stones anymore, Richard." "The ardour," he said. I nodded. "I can't let you feed off me either." "I understand that," I said. He searched my face. "Then why are you here?" Had he really thought this was going to be some tearful reunion, some plea on my part to get him back in my bed? Part of me was pissed. Part of me was sad. None of me had time for it. The werewolf that's been raping and killing women here got away from the police today.
"I haven't seen anything on the news."
"We're trying to keep it quiet."
"You're here for business."
His voice was soft. "I'm here to keep other women from dying." He got up from the table, and I was afraid for a moment that he'd leave. But he took the tea cozy off the teapot and refreshed his mug.
"It's not one of my wolves, Anita."
"I know that." He turned, and there was the first hint of anger.
"Then what do you want from me?"
I sighed. "Richard, I love you. I may always love you, but I don't have time for this fight, not right now."
"Why not now?" he asked, and he was angry.
I opened the file folder and took out the first photo. I held it up so he could see it. He frowned, narrowing his eyes. Then finally his mind made sense of it, and total disgust filled his face. He turned away.
"Why are you showing me that?"
"He's killed 3 women here and over 6 in other countries. These are the only ones we know about. He's out there right now picking a new victim."
"I can't do anything about that."
"But I can, if you'll give me some werewolves to help track him." He looked at me then away, because I still had the photo showing.
"Track him? You mean like a dog?"
"No, most dogs won't track a shapeshifter. They're too scared of them."
"We're not animals, Anita."
"No, you're not. But in animal form, you have the nose of one. But you still have the brain of a person. You can track and think."
"Me? You expect me to do this?"
I shook my head and laid the photo down on the pile. I stood and spread the pile across his table. "No. But Jason would, and Jamil would if you asked him to. I'd say Sylvie, but she's not well enough to do much of anything."
"She challenged me and lost," Richard said. His eyes kept flicking to the photos on the table. Get those off my table. He's out there right now, about to turn another woman into so much meat. Fine. Fine, take Jason, take Jamil, take whoever the hell you want. Thank you. I started gathering the photos up. You didn't have to do it this way, Anita. What way? I asked, shutting the file over the gruesome photos. Harsh. You could have just asked me. Would you have said yes? I don't know, but those photos are going to haunt me. I saw the real deal, Richard. Your nightmares can't be worse than mine. He moved in one of those blurs of speed and grabbed my arm. Part of me thinks they're horrifying, just like I'm supposed to, but part of me likes the pictures. His fingers dug into my arm, bruising. Part of me just sees fresh meat. He let a growl trickle out from between his even white teeth. I'm sorry you hate what you are, Richard. He let go of me so fast I almost fell. Take the wolves you need and get out. If I could wave a magic wand over you and make you human, purely human, I'd do it, Richard. He looked at me. His eyes had bled to wolf amber. I believe you, but there isn't a magic wand. I am what I am, and nothing will ever change that. I'm sorry, Richard. I've decided to live, Anita. I looked at him. I'm sorry? I don't understand. I've been trying to die. I'm not going to die anymore. I'm going to live, whatever that means. I'm glad, but I wish you sounded happier about the choice. Go, Anita. You've got a murderer to catch. I did, and time was not on our side, but I still hated leaving him like this. I'll do what I can to help you, Richard. You know that. Like you help all your friends? I shook my head, gathered up the folder, and went for the door. When you want to talk and not fight, give me a call, Richard. And when you want to talk and not catch murderers, you give me a call. We left it at that. But I didn't have time to hold his hand, even if he would have let me. Van Anders was out there, and there were so many people he could hurt. What was a little emotional desolation between friends compared to getting Van Anders off the streets? Chapter 60. Jason and Jamil stayed in human form, while Norman and Patricia stayed in wolf form. I'd seen Norman in human form before, but I couldn't put a face on Patricia. She was just a big, shaggy wolf, pale, almost white. We had to put the two pony-sized wolves on leashes. Today, of all days, I did not want the police seeing a giant wolf running loose in the streets. I was thinking they'd be in a shoot-first, ask-questions-later sort of mood. I'd unzipped the two bags that I collected from Van Anders' rented apartment. The wolves sniffed it, growled, and on the end of leashes, they tracked him from the sidewalk around his apartment building and all through the city, and finally, to a mall. The police had been watching the airports, the bus stations, the highways. Van Anders was sitting in the freaking food court of the Eastfield Mall. He'd piled his hair up under a billed cap and added a cheap pair of sunglasses. As disguises went, it was okay. Besides, I couldn't complain much. I was wearing a billed cap with my hair up under it, and sunglasses. I hate it when the bad guys copy. I was also wearing a baggy t-shirt and baggy jeans with my Nikes. Short as I was, I looked like 1,000 teenagers wandering any mall in America. I deputized Jamil and Jason. They stayed out of sight, but warned me that he'd smell them sooner or later. I'd already flashed my badge at mall security. I'd made the decision that we wouldn't call the police, and we wouldn't try to evacuate. I had a court order of execution. I didn't have to give him a warning. I didn't have to do anything but kill him. It was mid-afternoon, so the food court wasn't too busy. That was good. There was a group of teenagers at the table nearest Van Anders. Why weren't they in school? At the table next closest to him was a mother with a baby in a stroller and two toddlers. Two toddlers, neither of them in baby seats, but running free, while she tried to help the baby eat soft-serve yogurt. Van Anders was still more than 15 feet from the rampaging toddlers. The teenagers were frightfully close, but I couldn't figure out how to get them to move. I was working up my nerve to wind my way through the daytime moms and kids when the teenagers got up, left the trash on the table, and walked away. Van Anders was as isolated as I was going to get him here in the mall. I wasn't willing to let him escape again. He was too dangerous. I made the decision in that moment, that I would endanger all these nice people, that the mother with her yogurt-smeared baby and the two screaming toddlers were going to have to take their chances. I was fairly certain I could control the situation well enough to keep them out of it, but I wasn't completely certain. All I knew for sure was that I was going to take him, now. I wasn't going to wait. I had my gun at my side, safety off, round-chambered long before I got to the table with the mother and her children. I had my federal marshal badge hanging out over the pocket of the large T-shirt, just in case some brave civilian decided to try and save Van Anders. I had the gun up and pointed as I passed the woman's table. I think it was her soft gasp that made him turn. He saw the badge and he smiled, taking another bite of his sandwich. He talked with his mouth full. "Are you going to warn me not to move? Tell me to freeze?" He sounded Dutch. "No," I said, and I shot him. The bullet spun him out of his chair, and I fired again before he hit the ground. The first one had been rushed, not lethal, but the second one was a solid body shot. I fired into his body twice more before I got close enough to watch his mouth open and shut. Blood blossomed from his lips and turned his blue shirt purple. I circled wide so I could get a clear headshot. He lay on his back and bled, and managed to cough blood and clear his throat enough to say, "Police have to give warning. Can't just shoot." I let out all the breath in my body and sighted on his forehead just above the eyes. "I'm not the police, Van Anders. I'm the executioner." His eyes widened, and he said, "No." I pulled the trigger and watched most of his face explode into an unrecognizable mess. His eyes had been bluer than in the photos. Chapter 61. Bradley called me at home that night. Strangely, after blowing a man's brains out in front of a lot of suburban moms and kids, I just wasn't in the mood to go into work. I was already tucked in bed with my favorite toy penguin, Sigmund, and Micah curled up beside me. Usually Micah's warmth was more comforting than a truckload of stuffed toys, but tonight I needed that choking grip on my favorite toy. Micah's arms were wonderful, but Sigmund never told me I was being silly or bloodthirsty. Neither had Micah, but I kept waiting for it.
"You made national news, and the Post-Dispatch is running a front-page picture of you executing Van Anders,"
Bradley said. "Yeah, turns out I was across from a camera store. Lucky me." Even to me, I sounded tired, or something more. What's more than tired? Dead?
"You going to be all right?"
he asked. I pulled Micah's arms closer around me, snuggled my head against his bare chest. I was still cold. How could I be cold under all these blankets? "I've got a few friends staying with me. They'll keep me from getting too morose."
"He needed killing, Anita."
"I know that."
"And what's the tone in your voice?"
"You haven't gotten to the part of the article where the 3-year-old boy is having screaming fits about me killing him, like you saw me do to the bad man in the mall, have you?"
"If he'd gotten away..."
"Just stop, Bradley. Just stop. I made the decision before I moved on him that witnesses' psyches weren't as important as a physical safety. I don't regret that decision. Much."
"Okay. I'll just talk business then. We think Leo Harlan is best known as Harlan Knox. He's worked with some of the same people that employed Heinrich and Van Anders."
"Why am I not surprised?" I said.
"We tried the number he gave you. The answering service says he's canceled his contract with them, except for one message."
I waited for it.
"You're not going to ask?"
"Just tell me, Bradley."
"Okay, here it goes. Ms. Blake, sorry we didn't get to raise my ancestor. In case you were wondering, he is real. But under the circumstances, I thought discretion the better part of valor. And the assignment has been canceled for the time being." "Do you understand what he means about the assignment being canceled?"
"I think so. I think he means the deal was called off. It got too messy. Thanks for checking, Bradley."
"Don't thank me, Anita. If I hadn't tried to get you onto our payroll as a federal agent, you might never have come to the attention of whoever hired Heinrich."
"You can't keep blaming yourself for that, Bradley. It's like spilled milk. Clean up the mess and move on."
"The same goes for Van Anders."
"I always give better advice than I take, Bradley. You should know that by now. He laughed, then said,
Watch your back, okay?
I will. You too.
Bye, Anita. Take care.
I was in the middle of saying you too when he hung up on me. What was it about working for law enforcement that gave you such bad phone manners? Nathaniel came into the bedroom with a copy of Charlotte's Web. It was in the kitchen, and it's got a second bookmark. I think Zane or somebody started reading it. I cuddled tighter in against Micah's body, and he held me, his arms warm and fierce as if he could squeeze the bad feelings out of me. Let them get their own copy, I said. Nathaniel smiled. Micah kissed the top of my head. Who's reading tonight? Nathaniel asked. I will, Micah said. Unless Anita wants to. I buried my face in the crook of his arm. No, being read to sounds just about right tonight. Nathaniel handed him the book and climbed into bed. I wasn't sure if it was the warmth of both of them under the covers or the sound of Micah's deep voice as he read. But slowly, I began to be warm again. I hadn't read Charlotte's Web in years. I was overdue. Overdue for so many things that didn't involve guns or killing people. Chapter 62. Dolph is still on leave, but I'm working on arranging a get-together between him, his wife, and their son and daughter-in-law. I don't know if there's anything to talk about, but Lucille, Mrs. Dolph, wants me to try. I'll try. Richard seems to have some peace. Not enough peace for us to date. But hey, I'm just thrilled that he's no longer suicidally depressed. At this point, I want him healthy and happy more than I want him with me. Asher, Jean-Claude, and I have an understanding. I guess you could say we're dating. You wouldn't think that dating two men simultaneously would be a first with me, but two men on the exact same date at the exact same time, that's new. Stephen and Gregory's father is still in town. Valentina and Bartolome asked Jean-Claude's permission to kill him. Jean-Claude said okay, as long as Stephen and Gregory agree. Stephen's therapist thinks it would be healthier if the boys handled it themselves. Gregory's comment had been, Oh, we get to kill him ourselves? That's not what he meant, Stephen said. The two of them are still arguing about how to handle their childhood nightmare come to town. I'm with Valentina and Bartolome on this one. Kill his ass. But I won't take the choice away from Stephen and Gregory, not if their therapist says it'll do more damage. God knows they've had enough damage in their lives already. But because they haven't been able to satisfy their debt of honor, the two child vampires are staying in St. Louis. Besides the debt of honor thing, I think Valentina doesn't want to be anywhere near Belmort when she goes up against the mother of all darkness. Me either. There are nights when I dream about the living dark. As long as I sleep with the cross on, I'm okay. But if I forget, she haunts me. I'd get a cross tattoo if I wasn't afraid it'd burst into flames. The Mobile Reserve has me on their list of civilian experts. They'll call me if they need me. Captain Parker was wicked pissed that the Fed's latest update on the preternatural wasn't so updated. The FBI just doesn't have enough friends that are monsters. If they did, they'd know more. Larry is back in town, all duly trained to be a federal marshal and vampire hunter. The wedding is set for October. Tammy is threatening to have me in the wedding. Some friends they are. We're still reading Charlotte's Web. The crickets sang in the grasses. They sang the song of summer's ending, a sad, monotonous song. Summer is over and gone, they sang. Over and gone, over and gone. Some people think that's a sad chapter, but it's always been one of my favorites. Summer is over and gone, but autumn is here, and next month is October. With the bluest skies of the year. For the first time in years, no, scratch that, for the first time ever, I've had someone to hold my hand and go walking out under those blue skies. Richard and I had always planned to do it, but he had his job and I had mine, and we never made the time. But now I have Micah, and I'm learning that you have to make time for what's important. You have to fight to carve little pieces of happiness out of your life. Or the everyday emergencies will eat up everything. When we finish Charlotte's Web, Nathaniel wants to read Treasure Island. Sounds good to me.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Cerulean Sins by Laurel K. Hamilton. read by Cynthia Holloway. This program was directed by Joyce Bean. Text copyright 2003 by Laurel K. Hamilton. Production copyright 2003, Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.